from petitioner.
Mr. Bill Connor will present argument for petitioner.
May it please the court. My name is Bill Conover, and I represent the Texas State Board of Dental Examiners in the case at bar. The issue in this case is whether the Court of Appeals erred in substituting its judgment for that of the agency in disputed issues of fact and opinion in the administrative hearing below. It is the board's position that there is reasonable evidence in the record to support its decision. This case arose out of concerns by the Department of Public Safety concerning several unusual Percodan prescriptions issued by Dr. Sizemore to some of his patients. The board, after investigating, initiated a complaint against Dr. Sizemore, alleging that he had engaged in unprofessional conduct by overprescribing Percodan to three of his patients, and that he had prescribed these drugs when they were not necessary or required in the practice of dentistry, and that he failed to note the prescription of over 800 dosages of Percodan in his patient records. At the hearing on these charges, the board received evidence in the form of testimony from Dr. Sizemore, including his admissions, the patient records, the original prescriptions, the triplicate prescription forms from the Department of Public Safety, and expert testimony from Dr. Arthur Jeske, a pharmacist and dentist. Dr. Jeske testified that the Percodan prescriptions were neither necessary or required, and that they could promote or further the addiction of the patients involved. Although he never examined the patients, he based his opinion based upon his knowledge of dentistry and pharmacology and the learned treatise before the commission. At the conclusion of the evidence, the board voted to suspend the appellant's license, Dr. Sizemore's license, for a period of 5 years with all but 120 days probated, probated on the condition that he surrendered his DEA certificates. Dr. Sizemore appealed the decision to the district court, which affirmed the board's decision, and thereafter Dr. Sizemore appealed to the Court of Appeals. In the Court of Appeals, the court reversed the district court's opinion. Thereafter, this board requested this petition for application for writ of error. Before the board, there were 13 findings of facts that were made. These findings were supported by the evidence in the record. All but three of the findings are uncontested in this case. Finding of fact number six, concerned the amount of Percodan that was issued to patient McKay. Patient McKay received 280 Percodan prescriptions. Dr. Jeske testified that Percodan was a narcotic and highly addictive, and that the amounts that Dr. Sizemore had prescribed to patient McKay were in excess of generally accepted dosages for dental treatment. Clearly, the Court of Appeals substituted its judgment for that of the agency in making a conclusion to the contrary. The second patient, patient Sabato, received 220 dosages of Percodan. The amount was said by Dr. Jeske to have been in excess of generally accepted dosages for dental treatment. Dr. Jeske testified as to the narcotic effects of Percodan, a Schedule II narcotic. He also testified that Percodan contains aspirin, and Mrs. Sabato had indicated in her patient records that she was allergic to aspirin. The Court of Appeals therefore erred in substituting its judgment for that of the agency in determining that it was not negligence to supply patient Sabato with these prescriptions. The evidence also showed that patient Sabato altered the prescriptions on some of the prescriptions to obtain more of the Percodan than originally issued. The Court is to resolve conflicts like this in the favor of the agency. The third patient involved, Dr. Cook prescribed Percodan to, was Mr. Cook, who received 382 dosage units of Percodan. Dr. Sizemore admitted this, and Dr. Jeske testified that as a narcotic that was addictive, that there, that as a narcotic, which has addictive effects, that there was too much prescribed to this patient. Sizemore, on this count, even admitted negligence in failing to notice the excessive quantities. The court, therefore, could easily concluded that the reasonable minds could have reached the decision the board must have reached in order to justify its action. It would have required no great leap of faith under the evidence before the board for the Court of Appeals to have concluded, as did the board and the trial court, that Dr. Sizemore prescribed controlled substances in a manner not necessary or required and in a manner which would promote and further the addiction of the patients. It would not take a great leap of faith for the Court of Appeals, as did the board and the district court, to find that Dr. Sizemore had engaged in grossly unprofessional conduct in failing in prescribing Percodan in excess. And even by the Court of Appeals' own admission, it required very little evidence to prove that Dr. Sizemore failed to note the prescriptions of these Percodan in his patient records. Dr. Sizemore admitted that failure. The district court so found, and the Court of Appeals even found that the patient records failed to indicate the prescription of these narcotic drugs. How is it then that the Court of Appeals, in reversed the district court and the board? The Court of Appeals misapplied the proper standard of review to be used by a court in reviewing a decision of an administrative agency to suspend or revoke a professional license. The burden of proof is upon the person challenging the order of an administrative agency to demonstrate the invalidity of that order. Otherwise, the order is presumptively valid. In making this review, the reviewing court is prohibited by Section 19 of the Administrative Procedures Act from substituting its judgment for that of the agency on disputed issues of fact and opinion, even though it might have struck a different balance. The respondent here has not met his burden of proof that the decision lacks substantial evidence, leaving the prima facie presumption of its validity unrebutted. Dr. Sizemore relies upon the Fenlaw case, which was a pre-APTRA opinion, for the proposition that there must be proof of conduct injurious to the public welfare and that that conduct must be substantial. Nowhere in the Fenlaw case can that language be found. Indeed, the Fenlaw case should be read to give wide discretion to the agency in making findings of facts and conclusions of law. And I would note that even in the Fenlaw case, the standard of review utilized by the agency was a substantial evidence standard of review and not a preponderance of the evidence or some other standard of review.
Mr. Canova?
Yes, sir.
The standard of review before the Court of Appeals was substantial evidence. The majority found that there was a lack of substantial evidence to support the board's order.
Yes, sir.
What is standard review here before?
Well, I think that the court is to look at the agency's decision and determine whether there are sufficiently clear, specific, and non-conclusory findings of facts to support the conclusions of law issued in the order of the board. This is something that this court should do. However, the Court of Appeals, it appears, failed to do that. The Court of Appeals engaged in a hyper-technical review of the agency regulations.
If the standard review before is the same as the Court of Appeals, and that is substantial evidence, will we not be substituting our judgment for the Court of Appeals?
The standard of review is on the agency's order and not on as far as determining whether there's substantial evidence in the agency's decision to support the order of the board. And that's not to say that this court is to review the Court of Appeals' decision under the same standard. There is an error of law committed by the Court of Appeals, which I think this court may correct without looking
at. What error was that?
The error was in not properly analyzing the board's decision under the substantial evidence test.
If they use the proper standard, the standard is what is the law, the matter of law, not the application.
Well, the standard that was used by the Court of Appeals, while it was purported to be a substantial evidence standard, added the standard that there be proof of conduct injurious to the public welfare, and that such evidence must be substantial. That is, the language in that opinion clearly demonstrates a misunderstanding of what a substantial evidence review involves. Substantial evidence only is greater than a preponderance, but less is greater than a scintilla, but less than a preponderance of the evidence, and it's a standard of review by a reviewing court. The Court of Appeals added an additional standard, saying that there was supposed to be an additional proof at the board level, which the statute didn't require.
And that
was the error that the court committed. They required an additional burden. Board acknowledges that the regulations of the dental board are police powers and can only be exercised in the interest of preserving the public health, safety, and welfare. However, any time an agency acts to regulate, it is acting in the interest of the public health, safety, and welfare, absent a definite showing to the contrary, a clear showing that they were acting arbitrarily or without statutory authority. In this case, there's no such evidence. The evidence before the board and the court in its charter medical opinion and in Dotson require that the board look at all the evidence and find out whether or not reasonable minds could have reached the conclusion the board must have reached in order to justify its action. The record before this court shows that there was such evidence in the record. Dr. Sizemore admitted to almost every allegation. The only contest concerned whether there was sufficient evidence concerning the experts' analysis of the issues involved. And when there is a dispute among the dispute in the evidence, the conflicts or the ambiguities are to be resolved in favor of the agency adjudicators. This is the error that the Court of Appeals committed, that they did not resolve those conflicts or ambiguities in the evidence in favor of the agency, and decided that there was not a scintilla evidence, but there was no evidence in which to support the board's finding. The evidence before the court showed that Dr. Jeske's expertise went unchallenged. His expert testimony reflected that Percodan is addictive if used in sufficient quantity for a sufficient period of time. Expert testified that with a reasonable degree of medical certainty, the Percodan prescriptions were not necessary or required. Sizemore admitted his failure to record the prescriptions of these drugs, and he also admitted in the record that he may have been used by these patients. Sizemore's repeated failure to record the prescriptions for controlled substance was a direct violation of the board's rules and regulations. One of the analyses of this Court of Appeals hinged upon whether or not an expert could testify with the limiting phrase, in his opinion. Justice Howe, in his opinion, stated that it was improper for the expert to use the limiting phrase, in his opinion, in analyzing the prescriptions, the patient records, and the other evidence before them. This court has promulgated rules of evidence 703 and 705, which permit expert testimony in the form of opinion. The Court of Appeals, however, objected to the form of the opinion testimony and not the substance. Moreover, the Court of Appeals erred in holding that the evidence of record-keeping violations must be free from reasonable doubt. A reasonable doubt standard is a criminal standard. And had we been in a criminal proceeding, we'd be on the other side of the docket, in the north side of this building. Substantial evidence means greater than a scintilla, but less than a preponderance. Here, there is such evidence, and it required no other evidence. There is no need for any other evidence before the board in order for the board to make a finding and discipline a doctor for the dentist for failure to include over 800 dosage units of Percodan in his prescription records. Sizemore's statutory duties raises and irrebuttable presumption that he was negligent in the practice of dentistry, and that he, in the, that he failed to comply with a duty imposed upon him by law. The Court of Appeals, moreover, erred in such in remanding this case to the agency on allegations of record-keeping misconduct, where there was no abuse of discretion shown to have been committed by the agency. The penalty imposed by the board was well within its range of maximum allowable penalty. The board could have revoked the license. However, it chose to suspend the license for 5 years and probate all but 120 days of that probation. The effective date, or effective amount of suspension, was only 120 days. Surely the board has authority, in light of allegations like these, to take such action against a recalcitrant licensee. The propriety of a particular disciplinary sanction is best left to the agency discretion, unless there's a clear abuse of discretion is shown. Uniform, efficient, and effective enforcement of agency regulations are not possible if different courts throughout the state are entitled to make different determinations about the penalties and other issues which are properly within the primary jurisdiction of the agency. Since there is no clear abuse, the punishment should stand. In conclusion, we feel that the agency's order is reasonably supported by substantial evidence in view of the reliable and probative evidence in the record as a whole. The Court of Appeals erred in substituting its judgment for that of the agency on these disputed issues of fact and opinion. Therefore, this court should reverse the Court of Appeals, affirm the district court's opinion, and affirm the board. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We will now hear argument from respondent.
Mr. Joe Alfred Eisen, Jr. will present argument from respondent.
Your Honors, I feel it necessary to begin with a short rendition of the history of regulation of doctors in the state, because we stand here on the threshold of an important decision by the Supreme Court in a case where the Supreme Court has granted jurisdiction on a writ of error to determine not what the proper standard of review is in substantial evidence cases alone, but what the proper standard of review is in cases involving licensure and revocation or suspension of licenses under the substantial evidence rule, something my opponent in his argument has failed to concentrate on in this argument. Such cases have not been unknown to this court. One such case is cited by both sides, the Dotson case, which involved a doctor who was suspended or had his license revoked for prescribing narcotics in a situation where the doctor did not perform an examination on a patient before he prescribed the narcotics, where the patient was an undercover agent. In that particular case, the Supreme Court of Texas reversed the licensure suspension and penalties, citing that there was no evidence to support it, presumably on the basis that no examination of the patients had been made. Now, as we go back to the enactment of the Constitution of Texas in 1876, where there were remedies then for trial by jury, how are doctors regulated? It seems to indicate, and this was argued before the Court of Appeals, that a doctor whom the state sought to prevent from practicing at that time would have had a right to trial by jury in an injunctive process. After the 1876 Constitution was enacted, there were several statutes which in turn gave either right to trial by jury on suspension or gave right to de novo review if an administrative body voted that the license be revoked. Only recently have we had the incurrence of the substantial evidence rule, which did away with the de novo review, and now we're here under substantial evidence. But did we lose all of the safeguards constitutionally for the consideration of license revocation? Do we relegate a license revocation case to the same level as an application for a certificate of necessity and convenience for a hospital or for a public utility? I think not. And I think that's one of the premises of the Court of Appeals opinion. that the state of the law is not what the state board of dental examiners would have you believe. This is a major grab for administrative power. What they want a license from this court to be able to do is they want to be able to have an expert second guess and testify about what's good medical practice now without even examining the patients.
Did your client admit having prescribed this drug without proper record keeping?
That is correct.
Isn't that sufficient to revoke a license?
I think not.
Why not?
Not in the context of this order. Because he is cited for dishonorable conduct. He is cited for negligence in his practice. Now, these are meanings under the statute which broke interpretation. But keep in mind, Justice, that the Court of Appeals remanded the case to the administrative body below for imposition of punishment on the count you just spoke of. That is, on the rendition of the narcotics, the failure to note under that DPS statute the prescription of narcotics and triplicates.
Couldn't the commission come back with the identical punishment?
I think if they did in this particular case, when he has successfully appealed the rest of the orders, it would be clear what the position of the commission is, the State Board of Dental Examiners, rather. I don't think that could stand in a situation where he had successfully prosecuted his appeal on his other issues.
This is a criminal case, or if an appellate court reverses the conviction, the lower court can issue the identical punishment, not raise it. Why should that apply in situations like this?
I think in this particular situation, you would be punishing the man for not recognizing that him being found guilty on these other things that have been reversed has any merit whatsoever. I think you're getting into an either-or situation. See, the sentence was imposed for all of the misconduct that the state has spoken about, the alleged misconduct. Now, keep in mind here that their expert, Jeske, and you can read his cross-examination and compare it to his direct examination, failed to indicate that he had examined the patients. Now, at this late date before the Supreme Court here, we stand here, and this gentleman says that a woman altered her prescription because the evidence showed that she was addicted to the drugs, and it's Dr. Sizemore's fault. Well, there's no such evidence in the record. They weren't even concerned enough about their case in that regard to bring these people in as witnesses. And the burden of proof was on them. It was not on Sizemore when those administrative proceedings opened. And they didn't bring the patients in. There is a situation in this state where they're asking you to allow expert in a medical field that requires expert testimony to give an opinion, which is the basis for taking someone's license away without examining the patient.
You think it's necessary that the doctor or pharmacologist, I forget which, that testified that this drug was addictive and that this was too much, it's necessary for him to examine the patient?
Very definitely. Otherwise,
would a doctor have to have examined the patient to know that a gunshot wound is injurious to his health?
No.
Well, isn't that the same thing?
It's not the same thing, because all prescriptions of drugs, of narcotics, such as Percodan, are addictive. They have a tendency to addict.
Well, in his expert opinion, didn't he testify that it was addictive and that was too much?
Did he testify that was it addictive and was it too much? The answer is he gave an opinion without examining the patient that it was too much, and he also said on cross-examination that he couldn't give an opinion without examining the patient.
What could he have learned by examining the patient that he didn't know in order to testify?
What the condition of the patient was, and I'm glad you asked that question, because all these dosages that they make much of here are standard dosages. They were not increased, and Jeske admits that. There's a standard dose you give people for the effect of Percodan. For the painkiller. Two of the patients had dental infections. Their teeth were infected. One of the patients had temporomandibular joint pain. Indications in the chart of three patients suffering pain for which Percodan can be prescribed to relieve.
Describe the test used to determine whether substantial evidence exists in the administrative agency's ruling.
In this case?
Any case.
Well, I say that this case differs because it is a licensure revocation case.
Well, just give me the general rule, then give me the special rule.
Yes, sir. The general rule on a substantial evidence case is that there must be evidence, probative in the record, reasonable evidence to support the decision of the administrative body. They call that substantial evidence. Now, the test in a licensure case should be that this reasonable evidence that exists in the record is also a good cause or reasonable cause to invoke the licensure penalties.
Do you have any authority that the substantial evidence rule is different in the two type cases you've described?
The authorities I have been cited in my brief, and they are licensure revocation cases applying the substantial evidence test.
You say your brief. You filed a brief at this court?
Yes, sir. The brief at the Court of Appeals.
But you have not filed a brief with this court?
We have elected to stand on our brief with the Court of Appeals and have filed copies with the court. That, you
and
know,
you say cases in this court, but that's prior to the adoption of AFTRA, or the cases.
Dotson, no, sir. Dotson is not prior to the adoption of AFTRA, unless the adoption of AFTRA is prior to 1981, and I don't think it has been.
You're saying that Dotson, which I don't see cited in your brief, but you're saying that case sets up a different standard for licensure.
I do. I think it's not a different standard for substantial evidence, but it is something that they look at additionally. There's something additional they look at, and that's the quality of evidence to see if it merits the license revocation. Even the state, in its brief, the application for writ of error talks of good cause. There's a case in their brief that talks of good cause, which supports revocation of the license.
I'm still confused as to what the different standard is. I mean, there'd have to be on any administrative action substantial evidence to support the findings of fact and the conclusions of law that the administrative agency reaches. And if here it's to revoke or suspend the license.
I understand.
That's what you're looking at. I don't understand the, whatever you call it, the second part, the test, the add-on.
In this case, what's at issue is not prescription of narcotics per se, because Dr. Sizemore holds a license to prescribe narcotics. What's at issue is whether there was excessive dosages of narcotics which were not medically necessary or had no therapeutic value. And the argument I'm trying to advance here is the fact that an expert cannot tell whether they have therapeutic value unless he himself examines the patient. The whole premise of Dotson in reversing the suspension of the doctors in that particular case was the fact that they had prescribed narcotics to undercover agents without giving the agents an examination, which would have indicated then subjectively that they were under a painful condition, which would have then triggered the right of the medical licensee to go ahead and prescribe the narcotics.
Well, can you take the position that this expert, if he had looked at these patients, could have told at a later date that they were or had been in pain or that they were or had been addicted?
He could only have done so if that condition had continued. And in this particular case, the condition was either infection of teeth, incident to root canal procedures.
What purpose was the examination?
The purpose is that you should not be allowed to give an opinion as an expert to take away someone's license, claiming that they rendered dishonorable conduct or committed dishonorable conduct by excessive dosages if you haven't examined the patient.
Well, he talked about expert testimony. Very rarely does the expert, was he personally involved in the incident he's testifying to? Automobile wrecks, airplane crashes, pollution cases. Rarely are the experts, they're testifying from facts that have been supplied to them in a predicate question. Why isn't that permissible in a licensure case? What is there so sacred about a licensure case that it doesn't exist in other cases?
There's nothing about this case that doesn't exist in other license cases. What exists here, in this case, it might distinguish it from some other administrative cases, is that there's a statutorily given right to prescribe what otherwise is a dangerous narcotic. And the question is whether you use that right properly. And in medicine, it's not a science, it's an art. And you have to take the subjective complaints of the patients, you have to notice them in the chart. It was not said by Dr. Jeske that there was no condition of these patients which would have warranted the prescription of any drugs. The question was the quantity.
Now, the question before us is not any of that, as I understand it. The question is not whether or not the drug should have been prescribed or should not have been prescribed, or were prescribed too much or too little, or at the wrong time or too late or when. The only thing that's before us is, was there evidence that the agency could have based its decision on in doing what it did, whatever it did? Isn't that the only question? And isn't that a question of law, not a question of fact?
A question of law is a question of law based on fact. It is. You have to review the fact in order to get to the issue of law. It is a complicated proposition that has caused the courts of this state considerable difficulty.
A minute ago you were talking about the burden of the state was to do this and that. Isn't it your burden to show that the agency's decision was arbitrary and capricious?
On appeal?
Yes.
But again, I spoke earlier of what the burden was of the board at their hearing when they opened the evidence.
Okay.
The initial burden is on them.
Right.
Okay. And then when there's a decision such as this, you have to review it, and this is a licensure case, you have to review the facts then to see whether there is evidence which establishes good cause for the suspension of the license.
No,
which
we don't
is
have
also
to determine
reasonable.
That. We don't have to determine that. We just have to determine if there was enough evidence for the agency to have done it.
Okay, that's correct. There's enough evidence for the agency to determine.
The whole purpose of the substantial evidence rule was to keep these kinds of controversies out of the court unless they were arbitrary and capricious. For us to not have to retry this type of fact determination in the courts. Talking about the district court on up.
The
whole purpose of the substantial evidence rule. Excuse me?
There has not been a retrial. There has been review by the Court of Appeals of the quality and quantity of evidence under the substantial evidence rule. Your act is a review of the Supreme Court of the quality of the evidence and its substantive nature under the substantial evidence rule.
And I'm trying to keep us out of the morass of trying to redetermine fact issues. At this level, it's a question of law. Was there substantial evidence to support what the agency did? The question is, did the Court of Appeals invade, isn't it? It didn't, whether the Court of Appeals invaded that authority of the administrative agency to make those fact determinations.
Or the, yes, or the converse question. Was there any evidence of a substantial probative nature to support the suspension?
Counselor, let me move on.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Sizemore admitted failing to keep proper records of his patients.
That's correct.
Why isn't that enough for the board to have suspended his license if it did?
The court, to answer your question, in all honesty, the Court of Appeals could have reviewed all issues. They could have reversed the imposition of the sanctions on two of the issues, but left the sanctions the way they were on the third issue. It was in their power to do that.
They could have also affirmed based on this violation?
On one violation, yes,
yes
they could have.
Saying there was substantial evidence.
They chose to remand the case to the board for the reason that they said that they could not state with sufficient certainty in their minds that the imposition of the sentence would be the same.
These complaints against Dr. Sizemore occurred in 81 and 82?
Yes.
And he's been practicing dentistry all this time because he's had this case in litigation?
Yes. I'll tell you how that was done.
Why did it take so long? Here it is, 1988, and we're discussing matters that occurred in 1981.
I have no idea. All I can say is I filed everything I was supposed to in the Court of Appeals, and the case took 2 to 3 years sitting there.
In the Court of Appeals?
In the Dallas Court.
Yes. Yes. Now, keep in mind, we had an argument that he was entitled to a trial by jury, which they had mentioned in their brief, and I still think it's an open question. At oral argument at the Court of Appeals, that was seriously entertained, and it may have been that they debated on that for some time. The judge, one of the justices who took oral argument on the case, Justice Guittard, retired. That might have also resulted in the delay. But in this particular...
How did this get to be an en banc hearing? Was there an earlier three-judge opinion that we don't have?
I have no idea. The only thing I ever received was an en banc opinion.
Well, did you argue in front of all 13?
No.
You argued in front of three and got an opinion back from 13?
Yes, sir. Strange things happen sometimes.
Bargain day.
Well.
No explainer to Dallas Court.
I think what's at issue here is a simple thing. One of the major issues is whether you're going to make license review the same as any other administrative case.
Do you have any cases in other jurisdictions that draw this distinction and say that a license is somehow more, some license in hand is more sacred than a desire to open a hospital or some of the other examples you gave?
I represent to you that I have not cited any in my brief to the Court of
Appeals.
Well,
I can tell that.
I believe that they exist. I have read such cases.
It would help us.
I think
some of those cases. If you think there needs to be a different standard.
I understand Ms. Justice's argument, and I respect it. If you're going to treat all cases the same on administrative level, then the level of evidence is very low. It may be that you could still decide in this particular case, and I urge you to decide, that you cannot render a medical opinion on whether someone has a therapeutic need for narcotics unless you examine. Now, there is an exception
to
that.
I mean, it'd be very, very difficult. Here, the Department of Public Safety was just looking through prescriptions.
That's how this case was located.
And how many months or years after that, after the prescriptions were issued, did this all come about? Did the complaint come about?
Approximately a year.
So,
a year and a half.
You'd be automatically immune. I mean, any medical care provider would be under your standard.
No, that's not correct exactly, because I concede that you can look at the record. I didn't want to mislead the justices on that. There was record entries here about teeth infections in the medical records. There was record entry about temporomandibular joint pain. I mean, it was noted as an occurrence with the patient, with the examination. There are medical records to this effect, dental records. Now, my point is also, if Jeske, the expert, was basing his opinion on those records, then he can't base an opinion that these patients had no subjective therapeutic need for these narcotics based on the entries that are in the records, because they show that the patients had dental infections. Two of them were going to have root canals. One of them had a painful condition known as temporomandibular joint pain. And at least on cross-examination, he concedes that they could use narcotics on these patients. And I must quickly point out that they were in standard dosages, and Jeske testified that you have to keep increasing the dose to an addict. In other words, you'd have to step up the amount of narcotics that you were giving to continue the same effect, the same analgesic effect, the same effect of euphoria that they speak of with these drugs. And there is no evidence here that this doctor did anything but prescribe the standard doses.
How many of the members of the board that heard this administrative procedure against Dr. Sizemore were dentists?
I believe, let's see, about four or five. There was about seven or eight members of the board.
Four or five of them were dentists out of seven or eight?
Yes, sir.
So the whole board did not hear it?
No, there was lay representatives. They were not even dentists on this board. There was at least two of them, possibly three to four, that were not dentists.
But the state's brief has a list of the members of the board in front of it when they give the parties an interest, and they show nine people with doctor in front of their name and three lay people.
All right,
but you don't think all those people were there?
I can't challenge the number nine. I believe that they announced at the hearing that maybe one doctor or dentist could not attend that was normally on the board. But that would have made a larger number. It's been a long time since we were down there.
I'm looking at the findings and fines and orders, and I count eight dentists to sign the findings and fines.
Okay. There was not one. The ninth then would be missing.
Well, there were others showing absent or present and not voting, but eight signed, according to this. Eight dentists were present and signed the order.
I'm not challenging anything to do with a proper quorum. It would be too late to do that, or the fact that they didn't have enough there, that there are lay people that were on making up the board.
This rebuts your argument that there were only four or five dentists that passed on whether or not your client had done or practiced that dentistry to the.
I didn't mean to make that argument. In all candor, regardless of whether there were two and they'd staffed them with six lay people, I wouldn't be in a position to object, because I had the duty to object to the quorum at the time. I've not raised that as an issue coming up on this appeal in the quorum. I do feel strongly that if you read the Dotson decision, you'll find it in Congress to state that doctors can be suspended for prescribing narcotics to patients that they didn't examine, where regardless of what they enter in their medical records, falsely, if you will, they had a condition that they could therapeutically receive drugs. And now on the other hand, state that the state administrative body's expert can render an opinion based on the record alone, which the expert admits shows a need on the face of the record possibly for the therapeutic prescriptions.
Aren't in effect you asking us, you're asking us to say that the Court of Appeals, who has no dentist on it, knows more than the dentists that were on this board, and that the dentist's decision was arbitrary and capricious, and these appellate judges know more about it than they do? Isn't that what you're asking us to do?
No, sir.
Well, tell me why not.
Because it follows along with the decisions in the state, such as Dotson, which rely on certain principles in this area concerning prescription and narcotics. This is not first plowed ground. These cases have been plowed before. And when they do, certain things arise as legal principles in this area. And one of them is the importance of the examination, and the other is the necessity to show, or be some evidence to show, that the patients have no therapeutic need for the drug.
Is it your position that no expert can testify on a medical matter unless he examines the patient?
No.
I'm missing.
The testimony, again, I address that. You referred to the patient's records, and other justices have noted that after the fact, you can't examine a patient if he's already well and you're hired as an expert. Then you look at the records, what the doctor noted as the condition for the purpose of prescribing the drugs. And we have that in this case. And it conflicts with Dr. Jeske's expressed opinions by the state. His opinions, as I recall, and I think if you read the transcript you'll see, was that he could not say that any of these patients did not have a therapeutic need for drugs.
What you're saying, if I understand it correctly, in kind of a little short summary, is that three patients came to your dentist, and all three were suffering from pain, and the records reflect they were suffering from pain, which would allow the dentist to prescribe drugs. He prescribed the standard amount of drugs for that kind of pain.
Yes.
And then an expert comes in later, not having seen these three patients, looks at the cold record and says, based upon my looking at these records, these folks didn't need these drugs, and therefore you're in violation. And that's kind of where we are.
Not exactly, because he read the records, but the records only read one way. And they either say the patients have the dental infections and the temporal mandibular joint pain, or they don't. And that's the key. If they say they do have them, then they have a therapeutic need for drugs.
Well, I thought that the expert said that, not that the individual dosages, he gave 20 pills each time is too much, but that it went on for too long. That he should have referred the patients to an oral surgeon or tried some other kind of treatment that it was, may I misunderstand, but I thought what I read out of this was that 300 or pills to one, or 200 of pills to one person was too many. They could form a habit.
there was not.
If that wasn't curing the infection, then something else needed to be done.
There's not that standard for dentists. You don't subject a dentist to the standard of a doctor in treating infections. And they didn't prove that here. There's no testimony supporting that, except for Jesse's testimony, if you read his whole cross-examination, in which I asked him that. And he admitted that a dentist, if I recall, could not be called to account for failing to culture the infection. You can get all kinds of bugs in this world that don't respond to the standard antibiotic, and they can drag on and on and on, and you can't get rid of it. And if you were prescribing narcotics for the infection, it wouldn't go away. You could see where this situation would occur.
So a doctor would have to know that, but a dentist, because they're less trained in this area, should be allowed in the state to mistreat somebody for longer. Is that
the only thing I'm saying is that their expert Jeske refused to say that it was a violation of good dental practice not to culture the patient. That means take the culture of the throat, put it in a starch agar dish or whatever, and see what antibiotics were most effective.
But didn't Jeske say he should not have kept giving these patients Percodan over such an extended period of time?
He expressed that opinion on direct.
Yes.
He also expressed the opinion on cross-examination that he couldn't say at any specific time whether these patients needed the drugs or not. He couldn't discount the fact that they needed them because they had these medical conditions. This is a case unique where everything that's said on direct examination is canceled out in cross-examination. And that's another issue in this case. They want to be able to pick and choose, and perhaps that is the test. Perhaps an expert can get up on the stand and testify to various things on direct A through Z and testify to the exact opposite Z through A on cross, and then the agency gets to pick and choose.
Well, that's certainly our test on no evidence. And it falls into a gray area on the Court of Appeals review when we're talking about a jury trial.
I understand that, but...
Now, do you have cases that say, in substantial evidence review of an agency decision, that the court has to look at the direction of the cross and, as you say, cancel them out? Or
no, I do not. I do not have that. And I think it would be a sorry state of affairs if such could be brought about, that that would be substantial evidence, but I do not have such a case on.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Next, please, the court. The Court of Appeals' opinion below is clearly erroneous. This case was argued before Justice Guittard Howe McCraw, and after 15 to 18 months after argument, an unbanked decision was issued by the Court of Appeals. Mr. Eisen has raised the trial by jury issue, which I feel is adequately addressed in our brief, and I would urge the court to look at the Adams versus State Board of Chiropractors opinion, which was issued in January of this year, to aid the court in determining that issue. The board clearly believes that the right of jury trial does not exist under the statute, and indeed under the pre-APTRA law, even where there was a jury trial to review the board's decision, it was under a substantial evidence review standard. Every case relied upon by Dr. Sizemore seems to be a pre-APTRA case, which indicate that a practitioner need only have good cause to issue a prescription. On page 397 of the Court of Appeals opinion below, in footnote 4, Justice Howe states that the matter concerning dispensing of prescriptions has been left within the sound judgment of the practitioner issuing the prescription. Clearly, this is not the test for dispensing from narcotic drugs to patients. It is not within the sound discretion of any dentist to prescribe narcotic drugs which are not necessary or required in the practice of dentistry. The evidence below in the administrative hearing showed that on many of the occasions involved in the complaint, Dr. Sizemore never examined the patients. One patient repeatedly came into the office requesting more Percodan, but never submitted himself to examination by the doctor because he didn't have time. This is not the standard of practice of dentistry in the dental community in Texas that the dental board finds proper. Patients are not required to be interviewed by an expert. There are no cases that have been supplied by Dr. Sizemore. And there is no evidence to show that an expert cannot judge the therapeutic or non-therapeutic value of these prescriptions without reviewing the patients. Medicine is an art and not necessarily an exact science, but there are certain limits that the courts may look at and experts may look at in reviewing whether or not someone was practicing this art incorrectly. The board, in response and in reliance upon the decisions of this court, especially the Dotson case, bent over backwards to receive expert testimony concerning this issue. The board was following the standards set forth by this court in prosecuting a cause before an administrative agency. Probably the most appropriate words that sum up this whole case that I've heard today are those of Justice Speer, when he said that the whole purpose of the substantial evidence test is to keep courts from retrying all the issues that were heard before the board. Your questions here today concerning the detail and the facts and the nuances of Percodan prescriptions clearly show that this case has gone, that the analysis of substantial evidence is the proper analysis. You should not sit here trying to substitute as a dentist based upon the expertise that you've acquired from reading the briefs and the cases. You should be determining what this court should be determining, whether or not the Court of Appeals erred and whether or not there is substantial evidence in the administrative record below to support the agency's decision. To analyze the details of Percodan prescriptions and nuances thereto is not the function of this court. We feel, the board feels, that this case is supported by substantial evidence and that reasonable minds could have reached the conclusion that the board must have reached in order to justify its action. A suspension of 120 days isn't that great a penalty when the board could have imposed a revocation of the license. Certainly the board has the authority to make such orders.
Counsel, tell me briefly, if you can, what the public policy should be relative to whether they get a jury trial in the trial court or not.
The public policy?
I mean, you know, usually we try to give folks a jury trial. Why shouldn't they get a jury trial in this kind of case?
Well, the legislature has deemed that that dentists should not have a jury trial. The Constitution does not mandate a jury trial, as stated in my brief. And the legislature, as we know with the medical board and the chiropractic board and the other state agencies, has taken away the jury trial aspect and required that the board's decision be reviewed under substantial evidence review standards rather than a trial de novo.
Was it also because this right to trial by jury did not exist in common law at the time the Constitution was adopted?
It didn't exist in the Constitution at the time of the Republic. It was added in the first Constitution of the state. And then there were subsequent additions and deletions to the Constitution. And finally, I think in 1886, the Constitution was finally amended to where it was not a right of a dentist to have a trial by jury under the Constitution, although the statutes provided that they were part of the Medical Practice Act. In 1907, the legislature took the dentist out of the Medical Practices Act, and from 1907 to 1917, the dentists were unregulated in the state. In 1917, the legislature enacted 4548, which is a precursor to the current statutes, and that provided for a substantial evidence review as well as a trial de novo. And that was the type of case that the Sherman and the Finlaw cases, the type of statute that they were tried under. But they did have, even there, a substantial evidence review of the board's findings. Today we have some revised statutes from those times, but they only require substantial evidence review, and we also have the Administrative Procedures Act that requires a substantial evidence review.
Counsel, why do you think the legislature made a distinction between revoking a dentist's license and a lawyer's right to a trial by jury when you're trying to revoke his license?
As attorneys, we are officers of the court, and there's a separation of powers issue as to whether or not the legislature can regulate attorneys in that manner. Attorneys, being creatures of the court and officers of the court, are subject only to your regulation. The legislature, however,
can regulate dentists in a different manner or doctors in a different manner. There's no separation of powers issue involved.
And so that justifies a jury trial for a lawyer, but not a jury trial for a dentist or a doctor.
Well, the legislature must make its decision based upon a rational basis. And the standard that this court, I'm not certain what the standard would be in reviewing this court's action, but this court has made that decision in how to handle disciplinary actions of an attorney. And the legislature has made, and the legislature cannot invade that province of this court.
Any further questions? So, Mr. Thank you, counsel. That concludes the proceedings of the court for this morning. This case is...